before we start, okay, first of all, I want to welcome Zach Stauber back to Yeshiva. It's great to have him. And second of all, just between me and you, but those who chose four shiurim and a barbecue over Meron made the right choice. I'm just saying. Okay. So we're going to look at a famous Agadic story, which of course raises some larger questions about the nature of study of Agadah. So let me just mention a couple of things, and hopefully people in this room will get into the world of the Agadah. So one of the things that's tricky is that the standard Mefarshim are often not the ones that we study in Agadah. For example, if we're looking at a halakhic source in Gemara, clearly Tosfot is pretty dominant. Right? Tosfot did a great job. They try to reconcile all the halakhic statements in Shas. When we get to Agadic Gemaras, what tends to happen with Tosfot? They tend to not comment. That's actually manifest in the standard Vilna Shas. How do you tell an Agadic page from a halakhic page?
Doesn't have any Tosfot.
There's more Gemara. Right? If you look at the page in front of you, there's a ton of Gemara. Why is there a ton of Gemara? Well, in every Talmudic page, three people are, you know, competing for space. Rashi, the Gemara, and Tosfot. So if Tosfot doesn't have much to say, so the Gemara can kind of sneak in there and dominate more space. So notice, here's a famous Gemara, got one little Tosfot, and therefore there's a lot of Gemara words on the page. So a lot of the classic Mefarshim don't comment, but it doesn't mean there aren't Mefarshim, there are other commentaries to look at. So I'll just mention four places you might look, those of you who are studying Gemaras on your own and want to look at Agadah in depth. So the most famous commentary on Agadah is called the Marsha. He is published in the back of a Vilna Shas. You open the Mishnah to Marsha, and you'll see something interesting, guys. You can check this out later. You'll see that in the Marsha, there's both big print and small print. Why is there both big print and small print? Anyone know? Well, he actually wrote two commentaries, one in Halakha, one in Agadah, and then the printers decided to publish them together. But to differentiate between the two of them, you'll never guess who got the big print. Right, Halakha is in big print, and Agadah is in small print. So if you ever want to know where there's Agadic sections, if you open the Marsha and you can see small print, you know there's a lot of Agadah there. So that is one place to look. Okay. The second most famous commentary is by the Maharal. Okay, now this you wouldn't find in the back of the Mishnah, you find it in a separate four volumes called, easily enough, Chidushi Agadot Al-Shas. Okay, so you have the Marsha and the Maharal. Then, you know the famous collection of Agadah? Who collected the Agadah? What the book's called? Yeah?
Yitzhak Blau.
The famous one before that. Yes, very good. There's a work called Ein Yaakov. Ein Yaakov is just the Agadic sections of Shas. Okay, he leaves out all the halakhic sections, just the Agadic sections with various commentaries. Okay, so we've got Marsha, Maharal, and Ein Yaakov. And if it happens to be Masechet Brachot or Masechet Shabbat, granted it's only two Masechetot, but we have this wonderful commentary called Ein Ayah. Anytime you have a commentary with the word Ayah in it, you know?
Rukuk,
right? Avram Yitzchak HaKohen. Now, granted, it's only on two Masechetot, so you could say it's not too helpful. But what's a good thing to know about Masechet Brachot? It is full of Agadah. So even though it's only two, right, he picked two with a lot of Agadah. So again, so I would say, you guys want to study Agadah in depth, I would go Marsha, Maharal, and Yaakov. And if it's Brachot or Shabbat, then you can work with Rav Kook. Okay? Great. Let's go to the second thing I want to raise. Okay, so as you guys know, I wrote a book on Agadah. When I wrote a book, a woman named Simi Peters wrote a review of it. And she was mostly complimentary, but she had one criticism, which it's a very good rule for life. So when it first came out, I said, oh, that's a terrible criticism. I'm going to like write back and smash her. Then I realized a couple months later that she was right. So it's good I didn't write back. Okay, so what she wrote was as follows. She wrote, oh, this is a very nice book, a lot of good readings, but there's no methodology instructing the student how to go about interpreting and analyzing Agadah. So what I was going to respond was, like, you don't have to always be self-conscious about your methodology. Sometimes you could teach a methodology just by, well, give shiurim, and students will realize what you're doing. Right? You don't have to, like, step back and say, I am doing A, B, C, D. Just do it. Okay, so I still think there's truth to that response. But at the same time, maybe sometimes a kind of self-reflective look at what you're going about is helpful for people. Right? Here are some methods. So it's good, guys. Next time this happens to you and someone criticizes your writing, right, wait 2 months before you respond. Think it over a little bit. It is a good rule for life. So here's the story. So one of the things you do when you interpret Agadah, and here it's good because I will be a little bit more self-reflective, is like any story has a lot of details. And you always want to know, are the details just details or do they have symbolic significance? We discussed with Zemur Nebuchim about Tanakh analogy, like Tanakh metaphors or imagery. So I think in any literature you have that. So if you think about the stories, I'll give you some details we'll have and we'll try to think like, what methodology might be. Let's mention a couple of details. What details might you have in a story? Names. It's always the question, are names meaningful?
times.
Right. You have amounts of time, or I'll expand David's point, numbers, right? Our numbers meaningful. And you'll have certain objects, right? So that'd be just three things to think about anyway. Our names meaningful, our numbers meaningful, and our objects meaningful. Now, if I asked you just offhand, just again, we'll try to be Simi Peters-like, think of methodology. What might be make it more or less convincing that any of the above is meaningful or not? What might you start to suspect is meaningful? It's not just arbitrary number. It could have been any number. It could have been any name. Yeah, JJ?
It's not necessarily found. Like, it's rare. It's not found anywhere.
Okay, so it's something really unusual about it. Might be a clue. Although it's funny because you could go both ways with it, JJ. JJ's saying if I have an unusual name or number, that's striking. Can anyone give me the opposite argument?
Yeah. There's other places that also
use... Excellent. I think a basic question might be, with a number would be, do we see this number elsewhere? Does it have resonance in our tradition? That, I think, is crucial. For example, I'll give you just a couple examples, guys. You get it right away. Okay, let's say we see a Nagadic story which has 400 coins. Somebody pays 400 coins for something. Okay, does that have resonance in our tradition?
Avram paid
absolutely. So it's hard to... I think David is absolutely right. Oh, someone paid 400 coins. Maybe the story is meant to make us think about Avram buying a burial plot for Sarah, right? Or if we have, I don't know, 600,000 people attended an event. Okay, maybe what are we supposed to think about? Har Sinai, you see a Mitzrayim. So Jesse, you're not wrong, but I would say, I would often ask, does this item, does this number have other associations in our tradition? If it does, we work off that. If it doesn't, maybe not. Bill, I think it always works the way, like, poetry is like it also, right? If again, you go into English literature and you study poetry, what's the power of a symbol often? The symbol played a role somewhere in world literature. Yeah. Right, for example, I don't know, if you're reading a poem and there's an apple in a garden, right, maybe you should start to suspect it's supposed to have resonance to Gan Eden, right, or I know she was going to use a literature example. Let's say, I don't know, you have reference to, you know, a pound of flesh and taking money for interest, right, so the author wants you to think about the Merchant of Venice, right, so that would be a clue. Okay, anything else besides that? I think that's a good clue. We have JJ saying it's really unusual. We have it as resonant somewhere in our tradition. Yeah?
If there are very few details, but then one, like...
Excellent. What if it's extraneous? Like, I said before that in a story, you can't have a story that any... Like, there's no such thing as a bare-bones story with no details. It wouldn't be interesting at all. So some details are just to flesh out the story. But what if something seems really superfluous? To give you an example, in the famous story when prospective converts come to Shammai and Hillel, Shammai rejects them, right? And Hillel accepts them. So Shammai could reject them in 1,000 ways. Any remember in the Gemara how Shammai pushes them out? What does he use? He's got like a measuring rod for a builder. So I think you can make the Zach claim there. Wait, did we really need to know like which kind of item he pushed them out with? It would have been a different story if he used, I don't know, a hammer or like a chainsaw. Like, does it matter what he uses? Right, so maybe there we start to say, no, let's think, what could be the symbolic import of a measuring rod for a builder? So I think those are good questions. There's a methodology again, just to sum up what we've done so far. I would say look at the names, look at the numbers, look at the items, ask yourself, do they have resonance somewhere in our tradition? And also ask yourself, were they really superfluous and therefore something's going on? Yeah.
Do you think there's a difference when you're analyzing a data versus like analyzing poetry and just so like in terms of like methodology and like how you view the work and what you're trying to get out of it? Like, what is the difference?
It's a very good question, but I'm not sure like you're going to get into a discussion of analyzing poetry right now. We'll talk about it some other time. Okay? We're good? Okay. Okay, last thing. Oh, I forgot one more detail. Okay, so we discussed details within the story itself. I want to raise one more question. Okay, the last question is something that's gotten more and more interesting to me over the years. When I started out my yeshiva career, I didn't think about this at all, but I think about it more, which is the placement of a story. I mean, what is going on when Chazal places a story in a particular place? And there's two ways to think about it. Okay, one way to think about it is that Chazal had a lot of good stories, and what were they just waiting for? An opportunity to sneak them in, right? There was no deeper thought involved. This is, we've got my 400 good stories in my pocket, kind of one might say, like, you know, they're our big approach to life, and we're just looking for a place to sneak them in, right? If we come up with any association, we will, okay, we'll sneak in the story, okay? That's the way it goes. That's why, which again, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Why not? If you've got a great story, you're just waiting for a place to tell it, and you come up with some word association, and you tell the story. Okay, what's the alternative approach, of course? No, it was very well thought out. Oh, this story belongs here. Maybe it's tied to a larger theme in this Masechet, in this parak. Everyone see the question? Now, here's something which I find really fascinating. Okay, Josh, this is real. One of the rare instances where Hasidic thought and modern academia come together. You gotta love when that happens. Okay, it's not such a long list. Okay, but here's an example. Okay, so in the 20th century, Jewish studies became a thing even on university level, right? You have a professor of Talmud, etc., professor of Kabbalah even. Okay, so in the world of Agadic study, the first guy really put on the map was a fellow named Yonah Frankel. And Frankel was adamant, I'm not even sure why he was so adamant, every story has to be analyzed on its own, right? Don't look at larger context, don't bring in other things. A story should speak for itself, right? Jacob Glass, we have a similar theory in poetry with some people. Don't bring in any other information. The poem itself has to speak to me. So Frankel didn't care about the context. He would say, just analyze the story per se, okay? Now there's a younger fellow, those of you from Englewood may know him actually, named Jeff Rubenstein.
Oh, yeah.
So Rubenstein wrote a book called Talmudic Stories, you know? There you go, see? Okay, they just discussed Agadic placement this Shabbos, the Sohn family. Okay, so Jeff Rubenstein argues his book against Frankel, and Rubenstein argues that when the Chazal were not just, oh, we'll find somewhere, but they actually place a story, it really does belong. I mean, it doesn't have to be every case, but it often is a thought-out process. Okay, we've got that split, it's pretty interesting, Machloka. Now, I would also point out, like, sometimes people think, like, oh, either Frankel's right or Rubenstein's right. We don't have to be so black and white about it. Isn't it possible that sometimes Chazal functioned Rubenstein's way, and sometimes they functioned Frankel's way, right? It doesn't have to be all or nothing. But here's the interesting thing. Do you know which Hasidic thinker is on Rubenstein's side? Very good sign, Ginellis. Rav Tzadok. Exactly. Rav Tzadok famously says, and he thinks it is all or nothing, Rav Tzadok says, when Chazal put a story somewhere, it was not arbitrary, they weren't just looking for an opportunity, but they meant it to be there. Just to give you a famous example, great, you have to tell him, Justin, I keep sending messages, but I keep telling Jeff that like I'm bringing him into the yeshiva world. Okay, good. Was he happy?
Very happy.
Good. Okay. I once met him for coffee to discuss that. That was a lot of fun. Okay, so here we go. So here's a good Rav Tzadok example. The most famous Gemara about Churban Habayit, about what led to the Churban. Okay, what is that, guys? The most famous Gemara about the Churban. What this and this led to the destruction of the Beit Mikdash. Okay, the story of Kamsa. Bar Kamsa, very good, David Zwick. Anyone know which Masechet that story is in?
Gittin.
Okay, now let's say you're in the Frankel camp. What do you say? Chazal, this really powerful story. They were looking for a place to put it. Oh, we have a good place to put it. We'll sneak it here and get in. Right, that's all that's going on. But if you're in the Rav Tzadok camp, what might you start to think about? Anyone want to make a suggestion? Why it's in Gittin? Yeah? Yeah, absolutely. Rav Tzadok says it's obvious, right? We have a very common metaphor that the relationship between Am Yisrael and God is a marriage metaphor. So certainly Churban HaBayit could be viewed as some kind of breach or gap in the relationship. So maybe you're looking for that. Oh, Gittin is an appropriate place for that story. So that shows you really like this other kind of methodology that Rubenstein and Rav Tzadok would have. Think about why it might belong in the larger context there. Okay, we'll all go to that background. Yeah.
Does that mean that there's really just no Agadic stories that work well with the laws of Yom Tov and Sechet Beitza?
Cute, yeah. I guess Yom Tov and eggs just didn't inspire Agadah. Okay.
There's some Agadah stuff.
Look, as I said, Zach, I, even though Rav Tzadok does seem to make it like a universal claim, I'm not really sure why it has to be all or nothing. There could have been some technical factors and some kind of inherent factors, right? I don't know why I have to be black and white about this. Okay, so that's a good piece of background to the Word of Agadah study. Now let's look at a particular Agadah and plug in what we just did. Okay, so when we see Simi Peters, we'll say, oh, Ray Blau, he's now doing methodology. Okay, let us go to the wide lines here. Okay, we'll look at wide line number 10, I think. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. It says the end of the line, Ba'amai. Does everyone see that? Now, this is a good example we might call the technical approach. Why did this story come up? We're about to see the famous Rav Shimon Bar Yochai in the cave story. Why does it come up? Because there's a reference to Rabbi Yehuda earlier, and Yehuda gets a nickname. What's Rabbi Yehuda's nickname? He's Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom. What does that mean, Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom? What does it sound like, Rosh HaMedabrim? He's the head speaker. He's the keynote speaker. Okay, so the Gemara says, oh, that's interesting. How do you get that nickname? How do you get that title? So the Gemara says, V'amai Karule Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom. So again, it seems, guys, pay attention. I'm obviously setting up another possibility. It seems like, why does this story come in here? Simply to answer the question, how Rabbi Yehuda got that title. Okay, why was he Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom? The Yatri Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yosef Shimon, three scholars are sitting together, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yosef Shimon, the Yatav Yehuda Ben Gerim Gabayu, who's sitting with him? A fellow named? Yehuda Ben Gerim. Okay, now before we move on, we mentioned before the question whether names have meaning or not. What might you suggest at this point, guys? What? Well, if his name is like Yehuda ben Shimon, that doesn't sound so exciting. If his name is Yehuda ben Gerim, maybe that is telling. Why is Yehuda the son of converts? Okay, so let's keep going. So Yehuda ben Gerim sitting with them. Patak Reb Yehuda Amar. So now they start discussing the Romans, a little bit of a rabbinic debate about their attitude to Roman society. Okay, so what does Yehuda say? Kama na'im ma'asem shel umazu. What does Yehuda say? They're great, these Romans. Look at their deeds. What did they build for us? They brought civilization to the ancient world. Tiknu shvakim, now we have marketplaces. Tiknu gsharim, we have bridges. Tiknu merchatzot, what are merchatzot? Bathhouses, very good, Joe. It's just great. Till then, we were barbarians. Now, it was technology, civilization. So Rabbi Yehuda is very praiseworthy of the Romans. Rabbi Yossi shatak. Rabbi Yossi chooses to sit this one out. He's Switzerland, he's neutrality. Okay? Nana Rishum Bayochai, Vamar Rishum Bayochai says, what do you mean? They're terrible. Koma shit tiknu. Lo tiknu al tzarach atzman. Everything they fixed, they only did it for themselves. Tiknu shvakin. What are the marketplaces for? Lo shippen don't owe. That's where their prostitutes hang out. Merchatzot, bathhouses, lot dain ban atzman. They want to just pamper themselves in the bathhouses. Gisharim, what do the bridges do? Litol mehen meches. What's meches?
Toll.
Yeah, toll. Very good. In modern Israel, when you want to, if there's customs, it's called meches, right? You might, if you bring something in from abroad, you might have to pay meches, some kind of tax. Okay, so he's very negative. Okay, they brought these technological advances, but it's all for selfish or immoral purposes. Okay, so we have this debate about the Romans. Okay, are there any Monty Python fans in the group here? Yeah. That's it? You guys get the reference? Okay, good. Okay, so it's funny because every once in a while you're watching a movie, you say, there must be somebody Jewish who wrote that movie because they were thinking about a Gemara. Okay, so the only problem is like, there's nobody Jewish in Monty Python, so it doesn't really work over there. Okay, but in any case, let's keep going. Okay, so I have this debate. So now, says the Gemara, Halak Yehuda ben Gerim v'sipre d'vareihem. Yehuda ben Gerim went and told the story, v'nishmu l'malchut, and it got back to the authorities. Now Rashi does something very interesting here, which I think he's reading the Gemara very carefully. You could say this, Yehuda ben Gerim is an evil fellow. He's like a slanderer. He runs to tell the emperor about this conversation. Look what Rashi says. I want you guys to tell me how Rashi got this from the Gemara. Says Rashi on sipre d'vareihem, L'talmidav ol aviv v'imo. Who'd he tell it to?
His students.
Yeah, he wasn't like going to tell the Romans, try to get Rishon Baruch in trouble. He told the students, he told mom and dad, right? People like to tell mom and dad things. Actually, not to your teenager, then you don't like to tell mom and dad things. Okay? V'lo lashmian l'malchut. He was not trying to the malchut to hear it. V'nishmu ayidei ha-malchut. Now, before we get to, I think, the implications of Rashi, where do you think Rashi got this in the Gemara? Actually, Rashi was reading very carefully. Dan?
You said that it got back.
Very good. Look at the language of Gemara. It doesn't say Siper Devrayim L'malchut. It says Siper Devrayim V'nishmu L'malchut. So Gemara is being very careful. Rashi's on the money here. Now I think there's like a little lesson there also. It's true about a lot of life. Like we like to think in life that it's you know, we can keep secrets. It's really not a problem. Or I'll just tell X. It will never get back. Right? Life is not like that. It is extremely tricky. I'm not saying we can never tell any stories, but it's extremely tricky to keep a secret. Okay, I think you see this all the time in the news, right? Someone had a secret, it lasted a couple of years, eventually, you know, the truth comes out, you know, if you don't mind, but, you know, you pay off a mistress, and you think no one's ever going to hear about it, and then lo and behold, everyone knows about it a couple of years later, right? So it is not as easy to keep secrets as you might think. So here's like an interesting example. This guy Yehuda ben Gerim is not any evil or sinister. He says, what harm could be? I'll just tell my mom. Where's the harm in telling my mom? And somehow it does get back to the Roman authorities. Yeah.
You know the phrase, the saying about secrets?
About the walls of ears?
About keeping secrets?
Well, what is it?
Three can keep a secret, two of them are dead.
Okay. There you go. Not bad. Where'd you get it from, Dan Shapiro?
Father told
you. Okay. Okay. Oh, no, now we're getting meta over here. Okay. So that's the Rashi. Okay, now let's see what happens. What is the Roman reaction? So we're back in the Gemara now. Okay, Amru, they said, Yehuda Sheila, Yehuda that praised us, Yitaleh, what should happen to him? He gets raised up. Now remember, that seems to be the point of the whole story. Why are we bringing this whole story?
It's about
to explain how Yehuda got the title of Rosh HaMadabrim B'chol Makom. What does it sound now? What did the Romans say? Oh, we've got a rabbi who's pro-Roman? He's the key, we have a new edict. He's the keynote speaker at every event. Okay, so it sounds like that's how Yehuda got the title, and that's why the story is here. Okay, let's keep going. Yosi Sheshatak. And here's the interesting thing about the Romans. Apparently, neutrality was not an option for them either. You might say they'll punish Rashbi and reward Yehuda, but they also punish Rabbi Yosi. Yigala Letzipori. He has to go into exile in Tibor, right? Neutrality was not a good move. Not as bad as being negative, but he also gets punished. Yeah?
Wasn't Tibor wasn't that a big Jewish
community? Yes, but doesn't Yigal, so you want to say it's not a punishment? Doesn't Yigal sound like a punishment?
Yeah, there's exile. It's like, I exile you to, like,
look, you also have to check out when, let me just think historically, when Tzipori took off. It could be Tzipori took off later, I don't remember. You have to check our Jewish history.
Maybe he took off soon.
Maybe he was right.
Yeah, I'm not sure if at the time Tzipori was yet. You're right, at one point there was a large Jewish community in Tzipori, which I have to check out the years. That's a good question, Josh. Okay? We should check that out. In fact, if you want, right now, Josh, I don't mind if you get on your phone and check out when Tzipori became a big Jewish community. You're a righteous fellow. Okay, so let's keep going. Shimon Shikina, Shimon who criticized us, Yerei! So now it's a death penalty on Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. Now comes a part of the story people don't know. It's my favorite part of the story. Okay, which is, everyone knows Rav Shimon Bar Yochai hid in the cave. What people don't know is he had a previous hiding place. What was his first hiding place?
Sure.
The Beit Midrash, which I've wondered about for years. Like, what was he thinking? Oh, they'll never look for me here in the Beit Midrash. Right, so unless it was reverse psychology, I cannot figure it out. But let's keep going. Okay, so first goes, Azalu Bre, he and his son go, Tarshu Beit Midrasha. They're hiding in the Beit Midrash. Now, if they're in the Beit Midrash, they're still somewhat connected to society, right? And his wife could go see them. Kol Yom, every day, having Maitali Dvitayu, Rifta Vakuza Demaya. Dvitayu, his wife, would bring him Rifta, his bread and water. Vakarkin, he would eat, it was his great, he had a sandwich. Okay, so at this point, life's pretty good. He's in the Beit Midrash, hiding out there all day. Oh, it's like in a right though, when he had to like sleep in the base for missing Shabbos. Okay, he's in the base all day, and his wife brings him food. Things are pretty good. Okay. Kitakif Gzeirata, but the Roman edicts get more powerful. The Romans are clamping down on Am Yisrael. Amr Le Labre, he says to his son, okay, that was a famous quote, guys, which we'll discuss for 1 second, it'll do like a 2 second women's issue. Nashim Datan Kalyan, women have like lightheaded or they're somehow less intelligent. Dilma Mitsarila, maybe they'll torture her. Umigalalon, and she will reveal us. So again, this is worthy of a conversation. So I actually just had a meeting about this. You know, next year in the Israeli high school system, they're teaching Masechet Kiddushin. So I was at a group of educators, we had a meeting about, are people going to teach it sensitively or not? So it's very interesting, we broke into two groups. One discussed, how do you teach Aisha Niknait? What does the word Kinyan mean in this context? And one discussed this line of Nashim Datan Kalot, because this line, because that's, it appears two times in Shas. One is this time, and one is Kiddushin. So I was part of that group. We discussed how to teach it. So I'll just, I'm not going to go into a long tangent because I don't have only time for Rav Dovin. But I'll just mention two things. Okay, if you're curious, you come to me after like three different suggestions how to address it. Okay, actually, I'll tell you all three. We'll do it quickly. Okay, so I said, the woman running the panel, Miriam Reisler, turned to us and said, what would you guys say? So I said I have two approaches. One is what I call the balance approach. You can't just put one chazal, you have to look at all Mamre chazal. So the same way there's a chazal that says Nashim Datin Kalot, there's also a chazal that says they have a Bini Yetera, but it's a play on words, Vayiven Hashem Elkumet Hatzela, God created womankind, but instead of Vayiven, the language of Binyan, chazal read it as the language of
Bina,
understanding. So say you can't just put one chazal, right? On one end, there's a kind of a negative evaluation of women's intelligence. In other sources, there's a highly positive evaluation of women's intelligence. That was my first strategy. My second strategy was to realize, like, sometimes people blow something out of proportion. It's just like how dominant the theme it is. Like, let someone says, oh, Judaism, Nashim, Datan, Kalot is a dominant theme. So I'd say, wait, it's a dominant theme? It appears in Chazal a grand total of twice, only one of which has any halachic impact. Okay, it has to do with the laws of Yichud. I'm not getting into it right now. You can look it up in Kiddushin.pe. Okay, so it's not a dominant theme in Judaism. It's okay, it's a theme we have to deal with. Maybe it's a little troubling, but it is not a dominant theme. So that was my approach. You got to take another two approaches. A fellow named Moshe Shpeter, who teaches in the Tiv Meir in high school, he went to go with the historical approach. He said, you know, in a world where people aren't educated, if you're less educated, you can be taken advantage of more easily. So that's all what it means, right? It's the truth. In Talmudic times, men were more educated than women, and when you're less educated, you're more easily taken advantage of. That was his approach. And then a guy named Avi Wolfish wanted to say, sometimes you have a character trait which is a double-edged sword, that it has positive manifestations and negative manifestations. In the interest of time, I'm not going to get into it right now. That's what he went to do. So that was kind of an interesting conversation. Okay, be that as it may, let's go back to our story. Okay, so where are they in the Beit Midrash? What are they afraid of? She's going to reveal where they are. So now what do they do? Okay, Azlu Tashuba Marata. Where do they go now?
Kiv.
Get okay, Mitrakish Nisa, a miracle occurs. Ivrilu Charuva of Eina Demaya. Now they're going to starve because Now they're not connected to the wife. She can't bring them food anymore. What's created for them outside the cave?
A carob tree.
A carob tree and?
A stream.
Water. Okay, here we go, guys. Let's apply our methodology. We've got an object now, a carob tree. Right? Isn't that just a detail? It could have been an apple tree. It could have been oranges. It could have been persimmons. Or do carob trees have resonance for us? What do you guys say? In our tradition, any famous carob trees?
Yonah.
Ooh, good guess. I'm sorry, can you just fill this with cold water? Okay, Yonah was a good guess, except for one thing.
It's a client?
It's not a carob tree. Okay, it's a kikayon. Okay. Ah, very good. Joe Schnitz. Guys, don't think about it. You might look for the object in Tanakh, but you also might look for that object in other Talmudic stories. So carob trees play a role in a famous Talmudic story. Remember, Choni HaMagel sees the guy. Do you in time, Joe? That's what you know?
Yeah.
Okay. You see the guy planting, and what does Choni say to him? How long is it going to take to be your carob tree? How long is it take to bear fruit? What does the guy say?
70 years.
70 years. Wait. Yeah, he's so convinced you're still going to be alive in 70 years. What does the guy say? Gives a great answer.
It's not for me.
Just like my grandparents planted for me. I planted for them. Beautiful story. But wait. Now, again, I'm not saying it's 100% obvious. So the Marsha does this. The Marsha says, maybe we're supposed to hear that other carob tree. What's the symbolism of carob tree? Something that normally takes a long time to bear fruit. So he wants to argue it's just to enhance the miraculous quality here. Right? Not only is a carob tree created, but the kind of tree that normally is very slow to develop is immediately bearing fruit. Again, I'm not saying it's incredibly deep, but I think the Marsha is on the right track. Oh, we have a carob tree. Think about where else that is in our tradition, and let's see if we can plug that in. Yeah, Josh.
Is there also a carob tree in Volavashimari?
Yes, very good. Oh, excellent. Whoa, yeah. Josh Cohen.
It's like a... Shunabad and GTS.
Okay. Oh. Okay, well, that's it. All the GTS guys know I got that.
There you go.
Okay. So, although I think I told you a story once. Maybe I shared it already. You know, in a lot of yeshiva, there's a little bit of a bias against Agadah. Like, the real meat and potatoes is the halacha. In fact, you might even be in Shir one day where like the Rebbe kind of just like skips it or glosses it over. Right? If you ever heard got that? Like, maybe, for example, maybe you might be in Rav David Shir, for instance. Right? Just as an arbitrary example. Maybe that would happen. Okay. So, you know, it's one of my battles in life is to put Agadah back on the map. I think it's great material. I don't know if yeshiva should skip it. So I once got in my community, one of the advantages of getting tramps is you get tramps from very interesting people. So I got a tramp from a guy who's a professor of Talmud at Hebrew named Menachem Kahana. So it was great. I got to discuss like academic Talmud with him. It was a lot of fun. So we started talking about it. So I say, you know, I really like Agadah. And he says to me, but the real stuff is Halakha. I said, oh my God, it's bad enough I get in the yeshiva world. But I go to the academic world, I get the same thing. Right, hold it, get the same bias.
What did you respond to your support for Agadah?
No, we didn't end up debating it. I was just sitting there going like, oh my God, I can't escape it. Okay. in any case, so, wait, where was I in the middle of it in a second?
Carob tree.
Ah, so the carob tree seems to be a very pretty powerful symbol in Agadah. Because remember in the Tanur Shachinai story when Rabbi Elazar is trying to bring miracles to prove he's right? One of the things is that a carob tree gets uprooted. So I think at that point, it's hard to believe it's an accident. Like, how come carob trees just keep coming up? Right, it's in the Tanur Shachinai story, it's in the Choni HaMagel story, it's in this story. I think that would be evidence that it's not an arbitrary detail, that Charuv has certain symbolism. And given the Gemara and Tanit, maybe the proof is the symbolism is a slow developing fruit tree. Okay, back to Gemara. Very good, Josh. Okay, Vavi Mishach Minayu, they would throw off their clothes. Vavi Yatvi Ad Savarayu Bechala, they would sit up to their neck in sand. So apparently they didn't want their clothes to wear away. They didn't bring a whole wardrobe. They only brought what they were wearing. They're going to be there an extended period. So you know what? We'll leave our clothes on the side all day. We'll just sit in sand. It's not a problem because sand is covering our private parts. It's all okay. Kula Yoma Garsa, they would learn all day. The Eden Sluye, but when it was a time, Sluta, when it was a time to pray, very good. Love Shu, they would put on clothes. Mechasa Umatzlu, then they would pray. Vahadim Mishachu Menai, then they would take off their clothes. Kehekid Delolavadu, so they don't wear away. Now before we move on, there's another question I haven't raised yet, which is, can we derive halachic details from the Agadic story? That's a huge debate in our tradition, I'm not getting into right now. But it seems here that there is a hidden halachic detail. Do you notice what just happened? Yeah, it sounds like, if you're studying the Rashba and Ksuas, you don't have to be dressed. As long as your private parts are covered, we're okay. Right? But if you're davening, that's different. Davening is a time for being dressed, right? It does fit very nicely. What aspect, actually, the famous Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik might fit here. What aspect does tefillah have, arguably, that Torah does not have? Why would tefillah require better dress than Torah? What would you say?
Community.
Interesting. So David Lipschitz suggests community, although not sure that plays in here so much.
Saying it's
right?
Like sensitivity towards other people.
Okay, you're fair?
Standing before God.
Excellent. Very good, Joseph. There's a famous Reb Chaim Soloveitchik where he says there are different kinds of kavanah in davening. One kavanah is knowing what the words mean, but perhaps a more fundamental kavanah is a sense of dialogue with divinity, sense of dialogue with God. So you could do, there's no sense that Talmud Torah needs that. I mean, many of us do experience Talmud Torah as a profound religious encounter, but you don't have a sense of like dialogue with God in Talmud Torah, but Tefillah does. So one could easily argue how you look, how you comport yourself, there's more seriousness to Tefillah than Torah. I think it would fit in very nicely. You having a good Tomer? Okay, now before we move on, I want to tell you, actually no, let's keep moving on. I'll tell you this at the end. You'll see really clever Rav Cook. Okay, here we go. Now, how long do they stay there? Itvu Tresar Shani B'marata. They're in the cave for?
12 years.
So we would also ask, is 12 a common number in Chazal? Okay, next. At Elio v'kama pitzcha d'marata. Elio Anavi comes to the opening of the cave. Amar, man lo di labar yochai demit kesar. Who will tell Bar Yochai that the Caesar's dead? Apparently when the Caesar died, edicts were annulled. And therefore, ubatul gzeirate. Now there's no death anymore. You don't have to hang in. After 12 years, you can come back. Yeah.
Is that a similar thing towards like the, as the Kohen Gadol died?
Oh, that's interesting. Interesting parallel. Very interesting. Yes. Enough. Although this is apparently Roman law, right? Not Jewish law, but it is an interesting parallel, right?
There's also the parallel seeing the wife bringing the food. It's kind of reminiscent of the mother Mary.
Oh, wow, very good. Oh, wow, we're on a roll here. Very exciting. Okay, I've taught this many times, but David Lipschitz and Josh Cohen here are a Miklat imagery lurking in the background here. Very clever. Okay, Nafku, they go out. Chazu inshita kakarbi vizari. They see people plowing and planting. Now, think about it. All they've done for 12 years is learn Torah and Daven. They are kind of caught in their narrow world of spiritual pursuits. Say, plowing and planting? Amar manichin chayolam, these people abandon eternal life. V'oskin b'chayisha, they're involved in temporal life. They're furious. How could they do that? Ko makom shenot neinem, wherever they look, miyad nisraf, burns. Right? They can't reclaim society at this point. Right? All they see is people involved in the mundane. Okay. Yatzta bakol, heavenly voice comes, v'amam says them, lahakriv olami yatzatem, you guys came out to destroy my world. Chizru martem, get back in your cave. Okay, Hadr Azal Itvu Tracer Yachishata. How long did they sit now?
12 months.
12 months. Now again, since the number 12 comes up again, one starts to suspect 12 might be meaningful here. We have 12 years, then a period of 12 months. Okay. Yeah?
Especially because it could have just said 1 year.
Okay, very good. Oh, I got what JJ said? Excellent. Another part of the methodology might be, was there a simpler way to say it? 1 year is simpler than 12 months. So if you phrase this 12 months, you might be trying to get at something. That's an excellent point. Really excellent. Can I give you an example of that? I think I got this from my friend Yoni Grossman. Okay, when Avram is taking in the guests, is trying to describe what time of day it is. How does it describe it? He's sitting, kechom hayom. Let's just say for the sake of argument that's midday. So couldn't have said it's chatzot. Couldn't have said it's, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. What does chom hayom convey?
Hot.
And therefore, it's more impressive that he is running to take care of guests. Sometimes, like, which word you choose, you could have chosen a simple word, is very telling. So I think, very good, JJ. You could have said a year, and wanted to get that 12 in there again. 12 months. Okay, next. Amri, they said, Mishpat Rishon Gehenim 12 Yubet Chodesh. That's how long the evil get punished in Gehenom. Kind of interesting aside there. Yatzta Bat Kol, heavenly voice comes out, Vamra, Tsumi Maratchem, come out of the cave. Nafku, they come out. Kol, hey, now this is also interesting, lot. We're almost done here, guys. Kol heicha davi machi Rabbi Lazar. Rabbi Lazar is apparently still angry with the son. Every place he strikes, havi masi Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon cures. So they first were both angry when they first came out. Now Rabbi Lazar is angry, Shimon's calmer. Okay, anyone see perhaps a little message there that his son is the angry one and the father's calmer? What often happens in life? Right. The youth are more hot-headed, maybe more idealistic, but also more hot-headed. So if you look at, I'm not going to be inside, if you look at the morale, that's what the morale says. It's not surprising. Right? You're a 19-year-old fire breather, you want to perfect the world. I get a little older, you calm down a little bit, maybe with both a plus and a minus. You lose some of that idealism, but you're also less likely to set the world on fire. Right? So that maybe that's a good thing. Right? So here we have the son is still angry and the father's much calmer. Then, what happens? Okay. But I think about it, you have a term like the young radicals. Right? How often do you hear the term the old radicals? Right? This doesn't fit. No, you're not supposed to be radical when you're old. Like, if you see, like, a 72-year-old who's, like, still a hippie saying, like, let's destroy all the nukes, you start to get wonder a little bit. Okay. Like, I grew up ready. Yeah. Okay. What? It's true. I'm not saying it never happens. I'm saying it never happens. But, okay. Here we go. So, maybe I would say to Bernie Sanders, grow up ready. Okay. Okay, so here we go. Okay, so that's what we have here. So what's the conclusion? Amar lo, he says, Beni, my son, die lola manivata. Really, it's okay. We're enough for the world. We'll do our spiritual thing. Don't worry. Bahati panu demali shabta. Now it's Friday afternoon. Chazu husaba. They see an elderly fellow. Davinaket trei medani asa. He is holding two hadas branches, like hadasim from Sukkot, myrtle branches. Virat ben ashmasho. And he's running right before Shabbos. Amrule, they say to him, Hani lamilcha. Why are you carrying two myrtle branches Friday afternoon? Amrule lechvot Shabbos. I want to honor Shabbos. What Jew doesn't love Shabbos? So then they ask him a question. V'tiski lecha b'chad, tiski like sagi, isn't it sufficient to have one? You want to have a nice meal for Shabbos, why have two? They answer, this fellow answers, chad keneged zachor, v'chad keneged shamar. There's two themes in Shabbat, the positive and the negative, I want both. Okay, now he says, Amrlu the brave, Shimon Chai turns to his son, beautiful closing line, chazi kama chaviv and mitzvot al Yisrael. See how much the Jews love mitzvah. We don't have to be so negative to everybody. We can go over positive. Okay, that's the story. Okay, now let's do some deeper analysis here. So let's start with the last point. We talked about whether objects have significance. What's the last object we have?
The chasim.
Hadasim. Clearly, if I ask, do hadasim have resonance in our... By the way, oh, for the Sephardim in the room, Charles Dean is for you. Are you the only guy here? Is that true? Gabe, I'm sorry. Yeah. Sorry, Gabe, I didn't mean to leave out Persian. Okay. Gabe, our second son, might end up studying Persian in the army. Okay. We'll be able to talk to your dad. We'll be very excited. Okay. We'll see. Persian or Arabic? We're not sure yet. Okay, what? Yeah? Okay, so...
Why did you say
Farsi? Which country? Yeah, Ron. It's funny, because like we don't know what our older son does, but the second son, if he studies Arabic, we won't know which country he's dealing with. But if he says in Persian, it's going to be hard to keep a secret. There's only really one option there. Okay, so that'll be good. We'll finally know what he's doing. Okay. Okay, yeah, Arabic really doesn't narrow it down that much. Okay. So, Svarim are kind of into myrtle branches. Can you guys tell me if you do this? There's some Svarim that use it for besamim. Do you guys do that? You don't do that? No? Okay. So it seems to be like some kid. I'm sorry? Very good. It's another very interesting difference. I only discovered this year, guys. One rule for life, if you ever teach halacha and you come from your little like Ashkenazi background, like always check what the Sephardim do to be fair to them. So I get better and better every year because like, we just make all these assumptions. I'll give you one great example. Like once I got up before class in the Yeshiva of Lavish and I said, why do we read Kohelet on Sukkot? I thought I had a really good share on why we read Kohelet on Sukkot. Until I discovered that Sephardim don't. Right? It's like half the class is just staring at me and says, Rabbi, what are you talking about? It's like 10 minutes in, I realized Sephardim don't read Kohelet on Sukkot. Okay, so you got to check these things out before it. So give an example with Bisamim. What's the Mishnah Berurah Pesach for Ashkenazim? I don't care what item you're using. To simplify, say, Poyim Nibsamim. If it's a fruit, if it's grass, I don't care. But Sephardim are better at brachas than we are. They say, what are you talking about? Why can't we just make the right bracha? Right, so they would say, we don't make Nibsamim. If it's a fruit, we'll make the fruit bracha. If it's eight, we'll make the eighth bracha. Okay, so that is a good point. But this Gemara might fit into that connection. Okay, let's go back here for a second. So, beyond that issue, obviously, Hadassim, what could you think about?
Yeah.
Sukkot. Okay, but let's go one step further. And here, I'll credit Jeff Rubenstein again. This was my favorite idea in his book. This is in a footnote in Jeff's book. Okay? He says, wait, let's go a step further. What resonance does the Arba Minhag have in Chazal? So, Chazal famously compared the Arba Minhag to four parts of the body. That's one famous one. Other famous one?
Mishkan.
Four kinds of Jews. Right? What's the Etrog? It has both mitzvot and Torah. Masim Tov and Torah, because it's got both smell and taste. Does anyone know in that midrash what hadasim represent? Hadasim are those that have masim tovim, but don't have Torah. Does that fit the story?
Yeah.
Of course that fits the story. What do you have here? You have two great scholars who are kind of originally looking down at the community. Oh, the community, their ignoramus is, all they do is plow and plant all day. And what is the message to them at some point? No, there is real Jewish spirit and value to those simple farmers also. Look how they run to prepare for Shabbos. So I think Rubenstein's absolutely right here. The symbol works perfectly. but he's holding Hadas branches, he represents the Jew, who might not be so learned, but we should have great respect for that Jew also. He is also involved in all kinds of good things. Yes, Jonah?
Is he sort of commenting that his, like, his svara that, like, one for Shamar, one for Zafra is pretty made up? I mean, like, he's providing, like, a sort of logical, a Torah-based argument.
You're saying that reflects that he is learned, you're saying?
No, that he's not. That's sort of the fact that the argument he's making is not learned.
Ah, okay, interesting. You're saying it's kind of like more like a Balbatish svara, as it were.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Very interesting, Jonah. Okay, so I think it's a good example of how it could really affect the whole story. But now, let's go two steps further. What about placement? So we said that the placement could be just, we looked for a place, we had a good story, and we made a word connection. Can anyone tell me, wait, which Masechet is in? Shabbat? Even more specifically, I don't know what's true about the second parak of Shabbat. I'll tell you why, even if you're not an expert in Shas, you might know about the second parak of Shabbat. The second Shabbat is called Bamei Malikin. We read it every Friday night. Okay, what's it about? Getting ready
for Shabbos.
Isn't that the end? The keynote of the story? Yeah. The story ends on, oh, Jews who are eagerly getting ready for Shabbat. Mm. So I think here, the Rubenstein, Rav Tzadok argument is extremely convincing. It's not that it was arbitrarily put here. It could just either be Masechet Nidor or Masechet Beitzah. No, this is where it belongs. The second parak of Shabbat is about preparing for Shabbos. But that's even more interesting because it seems like we have an explanation why it's here. This story was here to explain the phrase Rosh HaMedabrim. What emerges? Even when the Gemara does that, that might not reflect what's really going on. Right? That's just this technical bridge to get to the story. But the reality is we wanted the story in the second parak because it really belongs here. Okay, last thing, and then I'll wrap it up. So I've given this share many times. This morning I was just glancing at Rav Kook and I found something really interesting. One other thing you might want to do in a story is there a theme running through? Now Josh and David want to find Ir Miklat running through. Clearly one theme that's running through here is like secluding yourself in the Beit Midrash world versus being part of the larger world, or squeeze on the cave world, I should say. That's obviously a theme. So Rav Kook claims that that theme is even earlier in the story. Okay, so I don't know if it's a little bit of a stretch, we'll see what you guys think. Here's two examples. Where, again, the two places they hide?
Beit
Midrash and the cave. You could argue that a cave is secluded, but a Beit Midrash doesn't have to be secluded. What if it's a community Beit Midrash? What if, like, all the carpenters come on Tuesday night for Daf Yomi? Right, so you might say, oh, so that's the Beit Midrash is still somehow being connected to society, and only then do they move on to this total disconnect. Maybe like different levels there. Okay, so that's one interesting thing. What about we saw the Torah versus Tefillah thing, right? In Torah, they are in sand. In Tefillah, they're clothed. Now, I made a halachic point before. As Joe said, Tefillah is standing before God. It might require greater respect and reverence. But Rav Kook does something very interesting. Okay? You really see why Rav Kook changes with the Haggadah study. It's much more enjoyable if he's there for Brachot and Shabbat. What might clothes represent in terms of like the question of being part of society and being secluded? Well, clothes are about civilization, right? Right? You might say, let's say you're Joe Schnitzer and you find that dress code's really restrictive. So you can't wait to get back to the apartment. You can change into your shorts. You're very excited about it because even Joe Schnitzer will not wear shorts in the base. Right, so in a certain sense, okay, but I'm in communal context then, I need to be clothed in a more respectful fashion. Right, but so then Rav Kook says, even there you get the same thing. When they're learning Torah, they're in total removal, right, and they're not even clothed. That's again this separation from society. When they're davening, and here Rav Kook assumes that when you're davening, you might be davening, we used it before, for the community. So davening brings back a little sense of connection to broader society. Oh, lo and behold, they're clothed for that. So yeah, maybe it's a little bit of a stretch, but I do think once we realize that this theme of society and seclusion is running through the story, then I think that it's pretty convincing. Okay, so just to sum up, I think we've done a good job of showing like how one might go about analyzing an Haggadah. Again, ask yourself these four questions. It's placed here. Is there a reason why it's placed here? Maybe there's a deep reason, maybe it's not. Ask yourself, are the names meaningful? Are the numbers meaningful? Right, we didn't really get to the 12, but it seems to be meaningful. Are the objects meaningful? And we argued that there are two objects that are quite meaningful, right? The carob tree has other Talmudic stories, right? The hadasim have other meanings in the word of Chazal. Those are all really good questions. Maybe I'll just close with one question, okay? Another possible factor might be if there's a shift. I think a shift could be meaningful. So I'm going to raise one shift, I'm just going to end with a question. Food for thought. What takes them out of the cave the first time? Eliyahu Navi. Does he directly tell them to leave the cave?
No, he just
says, who will inform Bar Yochai that the edict's over. What takes them out of the cave the second time? A bat kol. And how does it do it? It says, get out of the cave. Now again, I'm not giving an answer to it, but if there's that shift, I think a shift also makes you take notice. Like, how come the first time it's Elio kind of in indirect fashion, and the second time it is a bat kol in a direct command fashion? Guys, want to give you a chance to relax a little before Rav David. It's going to start in 10 minutes. Guys, it was a pleasure learning with you today. You should have a great day. Okay, there you go. Yeah.